In this episode of Flying Smarter, I'm looking at why you need to put your seat back and tray table up before landing. Then, for the main segment, StatusMatch.com CEO and former airline loyalty program head Mark Ross Smith joins me to talk about airline loyalty programs. He talks about the airline loyalty business model, current trends and challenges, his tips and advice for travelers, and much more. Welcome to episode 32 of Flying Smarter, the podcast that explores the fascinating world of air travel to help you become a smarter and savvier traveler. Let's get started. Why do you have to put your seat back and tray table up for landing? The requirement to have your tray table and your seat back up before landing is all about safety. Approach and landing are some of the most critical phases of the flight, and over half of all fatal accidents have occurred during final approach or landing. In the event of an accident that requires evacuation, a reclined seat can block or slow down access to the aisle for those in the row behind the seat that is reclined. Fully upright seats provide the most amount of space and best aisle access for those behind you. In the case of tray tables, it's also about providing efficient aisle access. As you know, you generally have to put your tray table up to access the aisle during your flight anyway, and if you're not in the aisle seat, others in your row may also have to do the same to allow you to get out. So in the case of an evacuation, tray tables that are down will block aisle access as well. Plus, if your tray table is down and there's a hard impact of some sort, it's possible that your tray table gets stuck in that position or the mechanism gets damaged, preventing you from putting it up, and that could also severely affect your ability and your seatmate's ability to get out, or even worse, trap you in your seat. In the case of an accident and evacuation, seconds matter, and for this reason, the seat back and tray tables up rule isn't just something that the airlines came up with, but is a safety requirement from regulators. Did you know that Dutch flag carrier KLM has a lineup of collectible miniature houses? KLM's Delft Blue miniature houses depict real Dutch buildings and are filled with gin. They've been around since the 1950s and are given as a gift to all passengers traveling in business class on KLM intercontinental flights. There are currently 103 different houses, and the airline releases a new one on October 7th each year to celebrate its birthday. Mark Ross Smith is the CEO and founder of StatusMatch.com, a company that creates loyalty customer acquisition technology products for airlines and helps travelers switch their loyalty tier status to a new airline or hotel to allow them to enjoy the perks of being a high-value traveler. He brings a wealth of knowledge about airline loyalty programs, having previously served as the head of Malaysia Airlines' Enrich Loyalty Program, where he managed the program to the most successful point in the history of the airline. He's also the editor of the blog Travel Data Daily, and his work has been featured on media outlets like Skift, CNN, The Economist, and the BBC. I'm so glad to have Mark here with me today. Mark, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Looking forward to exciting conversation today.
Me too. And so I want to talk to you today about the loyalty business and pick your brains on all your wealth of knowledge and experience that you have in terms of how things work in the airline industry and what it means to the consumers. To start, can you tell me about the airline loyalty business model itself?
So airline loyalty has been around for about 40 years. It's not a new thing. It's changed over the decades in how it works, the structure, and about 25 years ago, airlines realized there was a big opportunity to sell points and miles to third parties, which we now know today is basically, you know, credit cards and earning miles and that kind of stuff. But if we take a step back, you know, I sometimes think that airlines forget that their loyalty programs exist to serve the customer. They exist to serve the traveler, the people who put their bums on that seat every day and fly around the world and make them money. Right, that's really who this is designed for. And so over the decades, it's evolved a little more from a what we'll call a status recognition program, you know, people who fly a lot and recognition for flying, into more of a points and miles kind of type program. So one side of it is the points and miles, which is super duper lucrative. Yeah. The other side of loyalty is is the status tiers. And a lot of airlines have been neglecting, in my opinion, neglecting this for quite a while. You know, this is the silver, the gold, the platinum type stuff. And this is this side of the business is important because this is what generates ticket sales. This is what generates like selling seats for airlines, right? Like very few people will fly just to earn an extra 1,000 points or miles, right? But people will fly that extra ticket to get across the line to keep their gold status for another year. In fact, quite a lot of people will do that. And people have been doing this for many decades. And so if we talk about what is important in an airline loyalty business, you've really got two sides to it. One is sale of points and miles to banks and third parties and all, everything that goes with that, what it looks like. And then you've got the what I'll call status retailing, right? Which is how do you monetize and further incentivize people to fly or use status as a tool to get people to consider flying one brand over another. And that will drive ticket sales for airlines. That will drive, you know, put bums in seats and fill planes and, you know, airlines can start looking at new destinations, bring on more capacity, charge more for tickets, that kind of stuff. So that's where status kind of plays into the game. And for, you know, a well-run loyalty program needs a good combination of both. You can't have one or the other. You need both running together. They typically attract a different type of customer. And it's this synergy between the two. You can imagine like a Venn diagram, right? Once they've got set points and miles and only got status, either middle is all the magic, right? And you know, that's what we like to talk about is the middle stuff. That's the sexy stuff. That's what we see as travelers. We'll get into this a bit later. But you know, typically airlines, let's forget the last year, but airlines typically, when they sell tickets, they sell seats, that it's a low margin sort of transaction, right? If you're in a coach seat, you know, what's the margin on that seat? You know, 5%, maybe 10 if they're lucky, right? And, you know, so the airlines generate a lot of revenue from selling those seats, but generate not much profit. Again, we ignore the last year because the airlines are totally milking it today, but that won't last forever. And so when you have, you know, a low margin business, you need the repeat business. It's a lot cheaper to keep the customer than to pay and acquire a new customer, right? And on top of that, you're also trying to generate additional revenue, which is where ancillary revenue started sort of coming from. Because if you, again, if you've got 5-10% margin on a product, you need to try and drive up that the revenue, the high margin revenue from somewhere else. And that's where we started seeing ticket change fees, seat selection fees, bag fees started creeping in the 2000s, early 2000s. And then sort of ancillary revenue at airlines really started taking off. And that was about the same time that loyalty business models evolved at most of the large airlines, where they realized that selling points or miles to banks was extremely lucrative. And that has since transpired into its own business, its own division within an airline, right? So there was a report, an American Airlines SEC disclosure in 2021, where they said that the gross margin on selling miles to banks was around 71-72% gross margin, that was, and the net was around 50%. So 50% net margin on points, I mean, that's a high margin than Apple gets on selling products, right? And if you're selling billions and billions and billions and trillions of miles to banks at a 50% margin, you know, at some point the CFO wakes up and goes, hang on, there's actually quite a lot of money in this. And to the point where today, in my opinion, some airlines, they're not really airlines anymore. They're loyalty marketing companies that happen to fly planes around the world.
That's really interesting that you say that. And perhaps for the average traveler, even myself, when I use my credit card, we don't really understand what goes on behind the scenes from swiping the credit card to it becoming points and sort of what the transactions that happen are. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when you, on the credit card side, you get the credit card, typically a co-brand card, you know, the logo of the airline on it kind of thing. And you swipe your card at a merchant, the merchant pays a fee to accept the credit card, right? And in that fee, it gets split up between the, you know, the acquiring merchant and the basically the terminal that swiped it, they get a cut, and your credit card, that bank, they get a bit of that transaction revenue as well. And a part of that revenue is used to give you points and miles in your Brick and Flyer account. And so you can imagine how many people all around the country, around the world are spending on their credit cards every day, you know, tap, 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 tap. There is, I don't know how much, trillions of dollars being spent on credit cards every year. I don't know the number. It's a lot. And I think it was Qantas that disclosed that it was something like, I want to say 60, don't quote me, something percent of all transactions in Australia could earn Qantas points or were earning Qantas points. And if you think about like the scale that this is at and how many are earning those points from transactions, like that's a lot of money, right? And this is, it's the right type of money. It's high margin revenue, right? It's not the, you know, 1-2% margin stuff from selling tickets. It's the right type of money. That's what I call it. And because it's earning the right type of money, the way that the market values a business that has high margin, sustainable as well, because airline loyalty program revenue has been very consistent over decades versus airline revenue, which is, I mean, think during the last 2020, right? Think about what airline cash flow revenue looked like in 2020. Pretty disastrous, right? Loyalty revenue was very consistent. It dropped, but it was, it did, I think Qantas said it dropped 12% or something in 2020, right? Versus the airline's revenue, which dropped what? I don't know, 90%, right? 95%. So the airline loyalty, selling points and miles, all that kind of stuff is a very consistent business. So you can project where it's going to go in the future. And it's high margin. And the combination of these two things, and it's a big brand, right? The combination of these means that if you were to try and put a price tag on what that is worth as a business, it's more reliable, right? You'd feel more confident about putting a long-term valuation on it, you know, based on these factors. And that's what we've started to see in the market, where some of these loyalty programs are worth more than the airline itself.
So when you have a bank and then you have an airline, every time you quote unquote earn points through your bank is actually paying the airline in order to reward those points. Is that sort of how it works?
Exactly. So you swipe your card on, you know, your bank at that point is making it might be a couple of cents on the transaction, might be a couple of dollars, depending on how much you're spending. So they make money from that. Obviously, you might be paying credit card fees on that. You might be, you know, there's a big chunk of people that don't pay off balances every month. So they're revolving credit, you know, they're making, you know, interest off those people as well. And that's sort of a combination of might be Forex fees. You know, some cards still have fees for spending internationally. All these fees kind of add up and they build a way for banks to fund the purchase of points and miles, you know, from the airline on your behalf. So if we look at, you know, who's the real customer to the airline here, you could argue it's actually the bank. It's not you.
Now, as you've mentioned right at the beginning, I mean, loyalty programs have changed a lot over time. And especially in the last few years, there's been a lot of change in the airline industry. We're seeing things like devaluation or the end of COVID status extensions and whatnot in recent times. What do you see as the current trends or challenges in terms of loyalty programs, both either for airlines or for the traveler?
So you're totally right on the COVID status extensions. You know, anyone that had status at the end of 2019 up until for most airlines up until recently still had that status, you know, 2-3 years later. And, you know, I talk about what's happened in a bunch of airlines is we're seeing this what called downgrade tsunami, where there's so many people that had status that was sort of coming to an end. You know, I think in 2020, the message was, it's not your fault. You can't travel. We'll keep you at that gold level for another year, right? And then 2021, it's like, well, you've been loyal to us. We'll be loyal to you. So we're going to keep you there for another year. And then 2022 came along, you know, and with sort of at the tail end of 2022, airlines are looking at it and going, well, we're extremely profitable. Planes are full. Premium cabins are full. We're charging through the nose for a lot of tickets. Should we be extending status again? And there was a bit of a checkpoint there where a bunch of airlines said, we should extend it again for maybe other reasons, not to do with planes being full. And other airlines were like, well, it's time to downgrade, folks. And most airlines took the latter approach. And so what we're seeing in the first quarter of this year is millions of people lose status around the world. You know, Delta back in February, United started doing it. There's quite a lot of airlines, millions of people. And it, even more if you include, you know, hotels, car rental, these kind of, you know, programs as well. And for airlines, I believe this creates both a risk and an opportunity, right? So for anyone that's ever had, you know, like a gold status and they're being downgraded to silver or nothing, right? There's an emotional impact. I mean, I've been in this position many times. There's an emotional impact it has on you at that point. You're like, darn them. Yeah, they downgrade me. How dare they? Mm-hmm. I'll show them and not fly them, right? Even though it's your own fault for not keeping the status, not flying, I'm not doing what it takes to get there. You feel ownership of this status, right? And because of that, there's an emotional disconnect at that point. And people do and will seek alternatives at that stage, right? Sadly, when you're being downgraded, it's a bit too late to do something, right? If you know you are still got your gold status and you're about to lose it, that's actually the best time to do something about it, right? Because I mean, obviously we run statusmatch.com, but there's a way to keep that with another airline, perhaps for another year or so. So you can kick the problem down the road a little bit and just enjoy those gold perks for another year, right? So there's definitely a risk on airlines with this mass downgrade. We'll call it a status cliff is another word I've heard for it. And while there's a lot of downgrading, in my view, this represents a significant opportunity for airlines and hotels to go out there and acquire customers, because you've got millions of people losing status. And status matching as a concept, you know, it's been around for 35 years, not a new idea. It works really well. And so you've got millions of people being downgraded. You've got this way to acquire the people that is cheap or free. Does this not represent the largest customer acquisition opportunity in the history of airline aviation, right? And so there are definitely airlines that are going out there and aggressively looking for these customers. You know, it was last month, I believe Delta had four different status match programs running at the same time, you know, just after they'd downgraded quite a lot of people. And so, you know, they realized that replenishing their downgraded customers with new active flying people really interested in doing it is the way forward. So I think the next 3 to 9 months or so will be really interesting, and to see what kind of offers and are out there in the market and how aggressive some airlines get and hotels over others in terms of customer acquisition. So for, you know, you and me and the other millions of travelers out there that are in a position to take advantage of some of these things, I think it's a really exciting time over the coming year.
Yeah, for sure. And the one thing that you mentioned there that I just want to make sure our listeners understand is, for those who aren't familiar with the idea of status matching, can you just go over what that is really quickly?
So status matching started about 1986, not our business, but the concept of a status matching, which is, say you've got gold status in one airline or hotel, and you are thinking of trying a different airline. You don't want to start from the bottom. Right, you don't want to start from the base level, because you're a gold member already. You're used to the perks. You're used to the lounge access, the priority boarding, sitting at the front of the plane. You know, the welcome champagne on some airlines, not all, caveat. You're used to all these perks and benefits, and you don't want to start from the bottom by trying a new airline. And the idea is, you'll match your status. This other airline will match. You know, you got gold, they'll give you gold over here. And if another airline gives you gold because you've got gold over here, the idea is, hey, start flying us. You know, we've done the right thing by giving you the status up front, so you don't have to take those 20, 30, 50 flights to get there. Here it is, come fly us. And so for airlines, this is extremely powerful tool. You will then hopefully start flying them. Any business they got out of you at that point is entirely incremental, right? Because people are ultra hooked on airlines where they or hotels that they have status. You know, if you got status on airline, that drives 30 to 50% of revenue for airlines. People have elite status holders, right? It's the single most valuable group that an airline has, and so in theory, the more people that have status, the bigger that group sort of goes up. It's a stickiness factor to the airline. So status matching is like the number one cheapest way to unhook someone from one brand to another. It's very, very effective. And, you know, we've obviously built a platform around that to automate it and help people facilitate that process of, you know, trying a new brand.
Now, given the context of where we are today with loyalty programs and status, what advice or tips would you have for people when they're looking at loyalty programs, whether it's they're using them or comparing them or even selecting one?
I think, you know, getting back to basics sometimes is a good way to look at it. Staying with the same brand, you know, I think is quite helpful. You know, I follow my advice here, but you know, flying with the one airline or staying with the same hotel brand or chain or staying with the same alliance. So pooling your miles and your status into one account it seems like a basic thing, but even the pros don't do it. So, you know, if you can't, I'm making this up, but let's say you're in a hub of say American Airlines, right? If you can pull all your flights with American or One World Alliance, this ultimately will benefit you because you're going to have more miles there. You'll be more incentivized to fly other One World Airlines. It makes a lot more sense to get the credit card to do all those kind of things that the kind of behavior the airline wants to see. But ultimately, you will benefit as a traveler from that versus if you did the opposite, where you know, one day I'll fly this airline, then this airline, this airline, you know, and you're sort of sharing a business around a little bit. What that means is you just won't have enough aggregated, generally most people, in any one airline to really build up anything, any meaningful kind of relationship there. And so it's not really a hack, but it kind of is because some people don't do it. You know, just focusing on, you know, one, maybe two airlines, right? Have a backup, right? Have your main sort of go-to airline, have a backup because you can't always fly them. Same with hotels, you know, stick with a couple of brands. I mean, the last thing you need is a few thousand points in 10 different airline brands, mm-hmm. right? And then like, how do you use them? It becomes really difficult. I was personally in this same position recently. I had a bunch of miles with Singapore Airlines and they're about to expire. And I thought, you know, what am I going to do there? You know, they're kind of points that otherwise I wouldn't care that much about. And so I end up redeeming these points, not for a flight, but for some incense candles and a backpack and all the sort of stuff that actually is not the best value in the world. But it was either that or lose them, right? So you may as well take something rather than nothing. And, you know, whereas if I'd done the sensible thing and, you know, pulled my business into, you know, a different brand, you know, where I've got, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of millions of points, you know, I could have done more with them. I had more leverage to keep them, that kind of stuff. So totally recommend people just focus on one, maybe two brands at the most. You know, unless you're an ultra frequent flyer and you can sort of make sense to do that. Otherwise, stick with one brand.
Now, of course, there are a lot of airline loyalty programs out there. And before we wrap up, I'm curious to see what you think some of the top ones are. What do you think is one loyalty program that is very well developed and well run from a business perspective?
So I have the advantage of being in this industry and obviously loyalty programs I know pretty well. I speak to a lot of them. So I'm going to give this one to Air Canada and Aeroplan. And this comes because if you look at the global landscape of loyalty and what's happening there, they've been by far the most innovative in the last few years. They've done the most sort of interesting new partnerships. You know, they obviously brought the Aeroplan program back into the airline as well, which was a genius move. And they've created new partnerships. They've, you know, got a bunch of new earner and redemption partners as part of the program. And it feels like they are doing more. They're embracing innovation a lot more than other programs are. And I'm pretty sure that the business economics, you know, in the background there, are working out very, very well for the airline.
And I'll ask the flip side of that question then. What do you think is a very well-developed or well-built program for travelers?
Personally, I'm a big fan of Emirates program. I fly Emirates as well. I have status with Emirates. The way that I have been treated as a customer with them, and I'm only a gold member. I'm not platinum. I'm just an everyday person. You know, nobody. I'm somewhere in the middle there. I'm not this ultra VIP that gets, you know, amazing treatment. I'm somewhere in the middle. And, you know, when you've got a brand like Emirates is very interesting because everyone knows them, right? Mm-hmm. And that might be because they've got a fantastic product on board, might be because everyone likes the idea of having a shower on a plane or sitting at the bar and drinking cocktails. You know, mm-hmm. These things are absolutely part of it. But the customer side of it, which is really the status side of it, right? And how the brand makes you feel when you have status, right? So it's the little things. It's the, you sit down in your seat, the manager comes over and says, you know, welcome back. It's great to have you. You know, like you're economy class today, but can I get you a glass of champagne from business class, right? It's these little things that cost the airline very little, right? But it sticks in your mind, right? Mm-hmm. You go, wow, they totally didn't have to do that at all, mm-hmm. right? Like you and me and many people listening, I've flown enough to know that that example of the champagne business class is not entirely like, it's not a totally new thing, but it's good enough where you would feel valued by the airline at that point. It's not something you would expect every time, but it's a nice gesture. And you know, I think at least in my experience, Emirates does a fantastic job of this.
Mark Ross-Smith is the CEO of StatusMatch.com, which creates customer acquisition technology for airlines while also helping travelers enjoy the full potential of their loyalty and status. He is the editor of Travel Data Daily, a resource for loyalty program owners including airlines, hotels, and other industry professionals, and he also previously served as the head of Malaysia Airlines' loyalty program, Enrich. You can learn more about StatusMatch.com and Travel Data Daily on their respective websites, which are in the episode description below, and you can also find Mark on LinkedIn, and we'll also link to that as well. Well, thank you again, Mark, for being here. I certainly learned a lot, and I think our listeners will have too, and I'm glad you could come to share your knowledge and your experience.
This has been a fantastic conversation. Thanks for having me.
That brings us to the end of this episode of Flying Smarter. Please take a minute and follow us on social media, where you'll find things like podcast updates and sneak peeks. Flying Smarter is on Facebook and Instagram at Flying Smarter, and on Twitter at Flying_Smarter. We're also now on LinkedIn, so you can find the show there as well. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.